Suddenly Antoine slapped both palms flat on the table, rattling the teacups. The sound made Emily start.
"We found Joseph's last will and testament," he said, grinning widely. "He wrote to my son Antoine Jr., and the letter makes his intentions for the estate clear."
He looked very satisfied.
"Everything we've been telling the court for months is borne out. AJ has had the document in his possession for almost a year without realizing the importance of it."
They looked questioningly at one another around the table, Philomène to Emily, Theo to Joe, Mary to Josephine.
AJ thought the letter the fond musings of a troubled old man, and of no importance to anyone but himself. But when he told me, I grasped immediately its significance.
Antoine touched his own temple lightly, as if he were reliving the discovery of that moment.
The letter was written 3 months before poor Joseph performed those desperate last acts of a disturbed man.
He leaned in to visibly convey his reassurances to his audience on Cornfine Bayou.
"My strategy," he said, his voice barely above a whisper, "is to bring these affairs to conclusion. Something you can't do for yourselves because of your circumstances. The court would never seriously consider any petition from you directly, so you need someone working for you. Our settlement is your settlement."
"What is it you ask us to do?" said Philomène.
"Nothing, nothing at all," Antoine said. "I just came by to read the letter to you myself, in case you hear it from others and do not understand the meaning. You know how fond Joseph was of my AJ, like a son."
Emily glanced sidelong at Theo, his face rigid under the reference, and then at the letter Antoine held. Antoine allowed the paper to linger under her nose before pulling it back and adjusting his reading lens over the characters. Emily recognized Joseph's handwriting, the right-hand slant, the cramped letters in French, the signature. "Redemption Post Office, October the 27th, A.D., 1906. My dear cousin Antoine, you will excuse me for not answering your letter sooner. I will say to you I have been to New Orleans since you left school. It was on business, and I returned 8 days ago. I am very glad to know of your safe arrival at Memphis, Tennessee, especially after hearing about the disasters you narrowly avoided. Last Sunday, your father and your mother told me that you are at a new school that has been opened, and I think that will be a greater advantage to you. Now do as I told you at the station when you left. If anything should happen to me, no matter what, take possession of that which I have. I give you all that I have accumulated. That is my will. Not a cent for my brothers, remembering the ingratitude of which you know. Settle my accounts. Above all, do for my children, as I said. I transfer to you all my rights. Take care of this letter. Now work hard. This will be the last year of hard work for you. Try to work so to be received in the world. You know how difficult the field is, and you have tackled it with courage, and that is what makes me believe in you. As to the examination, you will go out one of the first, and afterwards you know, if your father cannot afford to do for you what you need, I will. Accept then my sincere friendship, your cousin, and if you need anything, write to me. Joseph Beale." Antoine stumbled slightly at the part referring to his inability to afford to do for his son, but he finished reading the letter with a flourish, allowing a dramatic pause to develop before he went on. "So you see," he said, directing the comment to Emily, "this letter makes it clear that Joseph wanted us to handle his affairs, that he trusted us to do the right thing for your children. It's the Grand Champs with their greedy handout that we need to fight. And with this, I'm prepared to take that hand out of our pocket once and for all." "What about the will? The one they found at his house?" Emily asked.
It was written after that letter.
Antoine talked directly to Emily, but she saw his eyes slide briefly to Theo before coming back to rest on hers. Theo's face was ashen as he stared down at the table, never lifting his head.
That was a mistake, never valid, Antoine said dismissively. And it seems the original has disappeared. Once this letter is recognized as the last will and testament, we can accomplish the same thing. Surely you trust us.
Emily said nothing, trying to shut out the memory of Joseph's visit to her the night before he was killed. The court would no doubt accept this old, stained letter once Antoine brought it forward, even though they had rejected the later will for not being in the proper form, and it was unlikely this letter would disappear.
I don't expect you to follow this, nothing to worry about, Antoine went on. But Joseph gave Lola a great deal of property when they first got married. A donation, like this land you're living on here. He regretted it immediately after they actually married, and he got her to sign it back over to him, in front of witnesses. Lola's people are trying to lay claim to that land as being hers, and rightfully theirs, now that she is dead. With this last will and testament, we'll prove that it all comes to us. Then we'll be able to see after you and your share once the law gets out of it. I just want to make sure there's no loose talk about Joseph and his wishes to have us handle the estate for him. Not that there would be, or that anyone would listen, but the law can be demanding. Better not to tangle over much with either the law or the Grand Chambre, eh?
Antoine gave a wink.
We can straighten everything out between us later, after it is finished.
They all sat quiet, alone with their thoughts. Emily wondered whom there was to truly mourn Joseph, other than his family on Cornfine Bayou. The trial spilled over into 2 years of appeals, moving from Colfax to New Orleans, where the Louisiana Supreme Court heard the case without anyone from Cornfine Bayou being involved in any way. Once again, the demands of farm life consumed them, and they seldom heard anything about the case or even spoke of it. Theo came back from Colfax one day, enraged, so filled with disbelief that they could hardly understand him.
"It was him," he said. "I heard his voice. I'm not likely to forget that, am I? The voice in the woods. He was in it with Antoine all along, doing the deed and then sitting on the police jury, cozy with the judge."
"Theo, calm down. Tell us what's happened. What voice in the woods?" Emily said, but her son wasn't listening.
Theo paced in the front room, his hands thrust deep into his pockets, his eyes narrow with rage.
"Antoine Morat cheated us. He has the court on his side, from here down to New Orleans. He never had any intention to do as Papa wished. They settled with Lola's family already. $12,000, and they aren't going to give us anything at all."
Emily tried to make sense of Theo's words. Was it all over?
"Did you talk to Antoine?"
Theo curled his lip.
"He laughed at me, him and his lawyer, just back from New Orleans and victory. He paid the Grandchamps off, but said we held no such legal claims. Well, I can get a lawyer, too."
"Theo, there's no more to be done."
Emily did her best to soothe her son. Suing Antoine and A.J. Morat was a man's way, full of strutting, with nothing to be gained in the long run. There had been murder over the land already. They weren't going to give it up now to an impotent colored man just because he shouted it was unfair. The women's way was more effective. They might be ignored, abused, or dominated, but in the end the women were more practical, keeping their eye on whatever prize was within their grasp. But Theo couldn't hear that in his current mood, not from her. Emily couldn't stop Theo from going to Montgomery to find a lawyer to represent the family. After the case was already cold,
Teo filed suit against A.J. Morat.
Emily knew it was as much about wanting to be seen as Joseph Beale's son as it was the land.
In 1909, his action was ineffective at best, presumptuous and dangerous at worst. They accepted his petition, then laughed him out of court.
"Bring back a paper saying Joseph Beale married your mama boy," the judge said, "and then we'll look at your claim."
Chapter 45.
Philomène carried the food tray down the hallway to the back bedroom she shared with Suzette. The old woman was asleep, breathing heavily. Philomène slid the tray on the bedside table and gently shook her mother awake. Suzette slowly shifted between sleep and wakefulness, cranky from the start.
"I want collard greens," she complained. "It's not the right season, Mama. We fixed up a nice plate so you could eat before everybody gets here."
"I want one of the others."
Suzette's voice was a petulant whine.
"You drop food all over me on purpose. You do that with Madame and she'll sell you off to the first one passing by. Sell you so quick your head spins. Away from everybody you know."
She leaned toward Philomène conspiratorially.
"You have to be careful. But I spit right in his wine glass. Listen to what I'm telling you. Pick your time. The rest isn't important. You do what you have to. They're all right, you know, if you know how to work with them."
"Uh-huh," Philomène said. "Sit up a little, Mama." Suzette chuckled.
"I changed my name. They can't find me now. You better believe they're out there looking, too. But I got them this time."
"It's hard to eat when you keep talking," Philomène said.
Suzette stopped and considered the plate of cut chicken, rice and gravy, green beans and cornbread.
"This doesn't have any taste."
"I'll put some more hot sauce on it for you, Mama."
"He up and married a white woman. Those babies have a chance, though."
Philomène studied the hand that gripped the spoon as she moved the food toward Suzette's mouth, and she found surprises there. Light and dark splotches speckled her hands, and the skin sagged around the colony of tiny wrinkles near her knuckles. Her grip was firm, but ropey veins protruded upward from under the skin, as if they were trying to escape their prison. If she didn't look at her hands, she could forget she was a 68-year-old woman. She had never been vain about her appearance, indifferent until she started to lose the things others envied. Her figure, the thin coolness of her hands, the luster of her thick hair, the elegant stiffness of her bearing. Her mother was petulant today, pushing her to the point where Philomène grew impatient, but she didn't like sending the young ones in to look after Suzette when she got this way. Suzette lived much of her time on the plantation, and there was no point in having them hearing too much of that. They had fought their way beyond it. They had their own land now and paid their taxes promptly every year. She had never once missed a payment since the time she had almost been late 25 years before in 1884. In certain moods, Suzette stroked Mary's sandy hair with gratitude and longing.
"Don't you ever let dark hands touch this," she would say. "You're too good for the likes of that. You come from quality, and you owe it to your children."
The problem was that neither Josephine nor Mary had an acceptable suitor, and they were already well into their prime marrying years. Philomène heard the boastful rooster outside as she fed Suzette her dinner. In her mind's eye, she could see the old red cock puff out his feathered chest in response to the first of the family to arrive outside, announcing each batch of visitors as they pulled up to the house. Right alongside, or from a more restful, shady spot, their ancient yellow dog would barely lift his head. The dog was another of the strays Suzette insisted they keep, back when she was still vigorous enough to take care of them. In his day he had been a good watchdog, but now he was blind in one eye, and great patches were gone from his once golden fur. The dog had conceded his custodial responsibilities to the rooster the year before. Unlike the dog that drowsed in the shade of the gallery, Sunday visiting day on Cornfine Bayou brimmed over with energy, life renewing itself. Philomène's children came, with their own futures in tow. Spouses, live-ins, children, grandchildren, stepchildren, in-laws. So many sometimes that it was hard to keep track. Philomène had borne 10, and 6 were able to come to her and pay their respects each week. 3 dead and buried in small mounds, taken before childhood, and one who had used his light color to run off to Texas and pass from the life they were living in Louisiana. Bette, the oldest, came with her new husband, the 3rd she was in the process of outliving, in a wagon full of squirming children, stepchildren, and grandchildren. Once her first husband died from fever, she had gone on to older men, widowers looking for a strong woman to take care of them, who would adapt to their set ways. Bette was that woman. She seemed to pick the ones too old to outlive her, but not so old that they couldn't give her more children. From hardy, long-life stock, she was no good living without a man. Philomène's youngest, Matchy, had married and had 2 quick babies already. He seemed happy enough. Her son Joseph had always been a ladies' man. There were so many Josephs in the family, they took to nicknames and initials. Philomène's son was Joe F., and he brought his Indian-looking wife, a pretty little thing who always brought to mind her grandfather Gerasim. She liked Fanny. The girl had been raised right, a pleasant young woman capable of making herself useful, and they already had 2 children, little Narcisse and Gertie. Philomène knew her son's nature, and she wasn't sure how long Fanny could hold Joe F.'s interest. Nick had already taken up with a baby-faced white woman from the hills named Kate, and they had a little girl named Orina, who was oh so sweet. Kate wasn't prepared to be a wife. Philomène didn't consider her cooking worth eating. She couldn't dress the deer Nick caught. Her garden went to seed from neglect, and she kept a dirty house. She had been cut off from her own family, probably because of Nick, but Philomène didn't ask. The girl pressured Nick until he took her up to Montgomery to get married before the baby was born. They didn't know either of them there, and Nick lied about his collar, so they married the couple. It might not be strictly legal, but the girl had her piece of paper, and she convinced herself that the children were going to be legitimate. Henry married a girl from over Compty way, but there were no children yet. And, of course, her Emily. On Sundays, Emily was the centerpiece in a house overrun with family. She carried on as if she had no cares in the world and refused to allow sorrow to come into her house for too long a stay. She fed everyone, young and old, colored and white. Her rules of conduct were few, but they couldn't be violated. Everyone past the age of crawling had to have at least a sip of her homemade wine shortly after coming through her door. Each mother had to control her own children, make sure they did not act like common riffraff, and were respectful of their elders. And after dinner, when the dishes were cleared and washed, and the smallest children laid down for their naps, Nick would pull out his fiddle. Alone in the middle of the front room, with the audience clapping and cheering her on, Emily would dance a spirited 3-step, as spry as they all remembered. The children were entranced, the adults impressed. No one dared to leave before she tired. No one wanted to. Sundays were the best time they had. Narcisse's son Ed always came alone to their Sunday dinners when he could. If he met any of them in town, there would be a curt acknowledging nod, white to color, but in the woods on Cornfine Bayou, they met like family. Joseph was still in the house with them, even though he had been dead for 2 years. Emily wouldn't speak his name out loud, but Philomène knew that she carried him with her in spirit. Her daughter had lost the freshness that had been captured so well in the oil painting over the mantel of their front room, but she was still a good-looking woman, trim and lively into middle age. She had learned to dance alone and not dwell on the past, a lesson she hadn't been able to pass on to her son. There was little to be done for the boy. He was grown, but Tio was one of the many Philomen had seen who took each hurt inside and nursed it until it threatened to rupture. She felt helpless when she thought about her grandson. Philomen realized that Suzette had slipped into sleep, and she wasn't sure how long she had allowed her reveries to keep her in the bedroom. Certainly longer than she intended. It wasn't in her nature to sit idly. There was always something to be done, some child to look after, a meal to cook, an animal to feed, clothes to mend, her mother less able to do for herself with each passing day. But she caught herself more often drowsing in the sun, taking too long to do too little. Like now. With Suzette fed and resting, Philomen went out to the front gallery to get some air. Two of the great-grandchildren had spoons from the kitchen and sat in the middle of small mounds of freshly loosened dirt in the front yard, seeing how deep a pit they could dig. Their faces and mouths were striped with the muddy remains of dirt they had eaten. Philomen swooped down on the children, yanking them upright by their collars, startling them into bewildered tears. She looked at the unmistakable signs, even as she began to comfort the children, blubbering and shaken, but it was too late. Digging in the front yard meant someone was going to die. 2 weeks later, Suzette passed over peacefully in her sleep. 85 had been a long, respectable life, and Philomen hoped Suzette was someplace now that offered more than the indignities she had borne in this one. If Emily was the bloom in Philomen's garden, and Elizabeth the root that reached down deep enough to anchor itself and search for nourishment, Suzette had been the soil itself, buffeted by winds, withstanding storms, baked by the sun. Philomen met her mother's death with grim acceptance. Death would be knocking on her own door soon enough, and she would have to let him in. She wasn't ready.
Chapter 46. Joseph Beale may not have been allowed to leave the inheritance that he intended, but he left a legacy that assured Tio's privilege among Negro and colored alike. Tio himself, along with his brothers and sisters, and his mother for that matter, could have passed for white anywhere in the country. Anywhere except for this part of Louisiana. His background dictated that he marry an as-yet unnamed but clearly defined wife who would bring more of the same to the table. White skin, light eyes, straight hair, Catholic upbringing. And fertile, so the next generation could put even more distance between themselves and Negroes and come closer to white. It was even possible for him to marry white, the way his Uncle Nick encouraged him to do. Generations had been sacrificed for his look. The thought filled Tio with such despair that sometimes he didn't know how he could go on. He spent hours locked in his own mind, playing with ways he could live out his life without this constant coil of hopeless entrapment. He thought about moving away from Louisiana and passing, like his uncle Eugène, but was sure he couldn't make it on his own. Deep down, he didn't think he could carry it off. Everyone would know he was an imposter. When he looked in a mirror, it was a haunted man who looked back at him, an incomplete man with flat eyes and a crippled soul, inadequate in every way that mattered, a man who stood by and did nothing to prevent his own father from being murdered, a man who couldn't live up to his responsibilities to those he should be able to protect, accepting crumbs instead of finding a way to win the inheritance that belonged to his family. Tio despised the man in the mirror, and with an uncharacteristic clarity, knew what he needed to do to break the chain. He didn't have the courage or the stamina to go up against Morat again. That was all over. The one thing he could do was to strengthen the blood of his own children. How many times had his mother told him blood was everything? She meant white blood,
but he didn't believe in that anymore. He would find a mother for his children who was everything he was not. Strong, determined, capable, unafraid, and not brought up with the same attitudes that in the end would keep the wheel going in the same direction. That meant a woman who had no pretensions toward being colored Creole. A Negro woman. This would be the boldest act of courage he had undertaken in the 30 years he had been on this earth, because it would run contrary to his mother's wishes. He looked again into the mirror. It would stop with him, and something new would begin again.
"Mama, this is Eva Pou," Tio said nervously in English.
Eva was the first girl he had ever brought home, and he counted on Emily's relief to give him an extra measure of forgiveness in his choice. He was 30, and Eva was 19. Tio hardened himself, conscious of the half-beat too long while Emily digested Eva. Nappy hair parted down the center and pulled back tightly in two coiled braids, accentuating the pretty roundness of her face. Her ginger-colored skin, her broad nose, and the freshly starched, ironed, and serviceable gingham dress free of frills. He had expected his mother's unspoken disapproval, but he had not anticipated the clear, level gaze that Eva gave Emily in return. No fluttering hands or averted eyes.
"Bonjour, Mademoiselle Eva. Voulez-vous de café?" Emily offered. "Mama, English, please," Tio rushed to say. "I told you Eva doesn't speak French."
Emily smiled charmingly at Eva, and Tio noted it was her polite, "Because you are a guest in my house and I was brought up properly, I choose to extend you this courtesy," smile she reserved for company.
"Welcome to Confine Bayou, Mademoiselle Eva," Emily said. "May I offer you coffee?"
"Yes, ma'am," Eva said. "Would you like any help?"
"No, no."
Emily kept her eyes on the girl.
"Josephine will bring it."
Eva looked around appreciatively. "You keep a lovely home here, ma'am."
"Thank you."
Emily sat and motioned for Eva to do the same.
"I understand you live in Colfax. Which church do you attend up there?"
"Pilgrim Rest Baptist, ma'am. I go every Sunday."
"Well, here's Josephine with the coffee at last. Shall we pour?"
Tio thought Eva held up to the rest of the afternoon very well. The courtship was short. In 1911, Tio Beale married Eva Brew and moved her into the house on Cornfine Bayou. In the winter of 1912, Tio approached his grandmother's room with a feeling of dread. Philomène battled pneumonia, and today had called for him by name. It was too much like the summons before Mémère Elizabeth died. She was small against the whiteness of the pillows, but even weakened, she still emitted a potent life force he felt from across the room. Philomène took both his hands in hers, rubbing them gently as she talked. The hands sliding over his own were dry and rough to the touch, but a strange warmth began to generate between them, as if they were building a fire together.
"Tio, I've never told you about the gift I had when I was young, because I thought it had left me for good."
Philomène's eyes were bright, almost fever-bright, Tio thought, but unclouded.
"I used to be able to see the future. Now it seems to have come back, at least a little. And it concerns you."
Tio was soothed by the calm certainty in her voice and the heat of her hands.
"I see a woman standing in front of a large room. People as far as the eye can see. Young and old, black and white, men and women. She talks, and they listen with their whole minds. There's respect in that room, and the woman in the front comes from us, from you." I tell you this, Tio, so you know that you and yours are going to be all right. Don't waste what came before. Add to it.
Tio didn't know what to say. He held her hand in his until she fell asleep. Philomène died later that night. Emily insisted on a family celebration, and then, just as it had been with Joseph, Philomène's name dropped from his mother's everyday speaking as well. On a pleasant evening the following spring, Emily, Mary, Tio, and Eva lingered around the kitchen table after supper. Joe had left the house to go courting, and Josephine had gone off to bed early with a headache. While the dishes soaked in the sink, Emily brought out a fresh gallon of home-brewed muscadine wine. She filled a glass tumbler for each of them, and Mary retrieved the black-and-white bones for dominoes.
"Do you know how to play, Eva?"
Tio asked, careful in his tone. Since her belly had gone big with their first child, she was less predictable in how she reacted to him.
"I'll be fine," Eva replied. "No need to know French to play dominoes."
It took Tio by surprise how fast with numbers Eva was. She held all of her bones in one hand close to her bosom, propped up over her smooth, round stomach, carefully watching every play on the table with intense concentration. She won the first game with apparent ease, beaming with delight. Tio felt a nice rosy glow. His wife was happy, he was happy, all seemed right with the world.
"Very lucky," Emily said, mixing up the bones for a rematch.
Eva won the second game as well.
"You need to try a little of my wine," Emily said, nodding toward Eva's untouched tumbler. "Loosen you up a bit."
"I'd do fine without it, Miss Emily," Eva said. "I'm surprised you can hold so much liquor. You're such a little woman."
Emily motioned for Mary to pour more into Tio's glass as well as her own.
"I never had been able to hit 100 pounds.
Emily turned to Tio and switched to French.
"That time, weighing myself on the current scales, 99. If I had known I was so close, I wouldn't have spit out my tobacco."
It was an old family joke, and they all laughed, except Eva. Eva noisily scraped her chair back from the table, took her tumbler full of wine, and poured it out in the sink, then began to wash the dishes they'd set to soak earlier.
"Maman, let's talk in English,"
Tio interrupted, casting a nervous eye over to Eva. Emily ignored him and continued on in her silken voice, the strong rise and fall of her Creole patois dominating the room. Tio knew that Eva wouldn't think of disrespecting his mother by talking back to her, but the time was fast approaching when he would have to take a stand between these two women, his mother and his wife, before they ground him to dust between them.
"We need to find a place of our own to rent," Eva said.
Their first year of marriage had been a constant battle of wills between Eva and Emily, although harsh words were never spoken directly.
"But there's plenty of room for us here," Tio protested. "And help with the baby. We don't have enough for our own place."
Eva wore a stubborn scowl, with her lips pursed tight and not open to challenge.
"We are both young and strong. It may not be considered proper in your family, but there is nothing wrong in taking in other people's washing and ironing as long as they pay me for it. And I can take care of Joseph Lee myself. I know you and Mama don't always see everything the same way, but, Tio, we have another child on the way. I appreciate what your Mama has done for us, but I'm raising our children my own way. They will be Baptists, and they will not speak French."
The years passed, Tio taking odd jobs and Eva in charge of the family and their small farm outside Colfax. By the time Eva's childbearing years wound down, they had 5 children. There were 4 boys, Joseph Lee, Theodore, Henry Earl, and Ivy, and the youngest, an untamed girl named Willie D. Strict and full of direction, Eva brooked no interference from anyone in raising them to be morally strong, neat, clean, and respectful. Tio's family still spent occasional Sunday afternoons on Cornfine Bayou. After Eva and the children walked the 2.5 miles back from church in Colfax, Tio hitched the mule and they all drove to Aloha. The young ones loved to visit the farm back in the country with their grandma Tiet, a spirited old woman who always had an inexhaustible supply of thick striped canes of sweet peppermint candy. Chapter 47. Colfax, Louisiana, 1936. Deep in thought, Emily unscrewed the lid from the top of the Red Rooster tin, slowing her pace as she walked to make sure she didn't drop the last of her snuff. Her grip wasn't as steady as it used to be. It was 29 years and 4 months to the day since her Joseph was taken, and even after all the time without him, lately she missed him with a ferocity that unnerved her. She felt an urgent need to talk to Philomène about her unsettling longings, but Emily had had to do without her mother's counsel and comfort for 24 years. She took the time to pinch together the final bits of moist, dark brown tobacco that remained in the tin, expertly transferring the stringy blend between her inside bottom lip and gum in one fluid motion. A familiar rush hit as the thick, syrupy liquid rose in her mouth. She spat just once, forcefully, into the fallen pine needles and dirt under her feet. A short, accurate shot. One more spit before getting on the bus, and she would be fine until she got all the way to Colfax. Everyone knew that Emily Fredieu could hold her juice. Yesterday, a mud dauber's nest had fallen from the roof of the house, a powerful and unlucky sign. And then Josephine, in a rare fit of pique over a stuck jar lid that refused to budge, had declared, "If I knew then what I know now, I would have married the darkest man I could find and had a house full of babies of my own." Out of nowhere, as if the fact that neither daughter ever married were her fault, Emily had decided at that moment to come to town today. It wasn't often anymore that Emily could be persuaded to leave the home place for any reason, even to keep the graves clean. But she had been feeling lately that if she didn't keep moving, God might think she was done and come to collect her early. Besides, wandering through a store would almost be like breathing in Joseph once again. Between the strength of the omen and her assorted pains, she had been able to sleep only fitfully last night, and had been up long before the rooster's first crow this morning. She wondered whether this was how her mother Philomène had felt at this age, or her mère Suzette, or even the dark old woman, Elizabeth. The women in her family all had a grip on living they didn't let go easily, no matter the limitations. The 3-mile walk through the Louisiana piney woods out to the road to catch the bus to Colfax seemed longer than she remembered, demanding more than her knees wanted to brace, more than her heart wanted to sponsor. She could have sent either Josephine or Mary to do the erranding when she saw they were getting low on Red Rooster, or waited until Sunday when the relations came to call. They were all willing to do for her if she asked. Trading her country time for town time put Emily in a reflective mood. Josephine's outburst yesterday notwithstanding, they got on well in the country, she and her daughters, growing most of what they needed to eat, using the muscadine grapes to make their own wine to drink, keeping the farm, having supplies they couldn't grow or make themselves brought in. Joe Jr. had died in World War I, but Tio frequently brought his children to visit. Despite being off in the back country, they seldom wanted for weekly visitors. Family of one sort or another, from the white side and the colored side, both. Going to town usually meant something new and pretty to see, even if Colfax seemed to be shrinking instead of growing. When the sawmill pulled out, The town had gotten a bit of a hangdog temperament to it, as if it knew its best days were behind. A black squirrel jumped from one tree to the next not far ahead of her, his mouth swollen with nuts. How she still loved her woods, even after all these years, even after most of the virgin pine had been plundered and the sun was free to burn through. It wasn't as if she didn't have other places to compare it with, like most of the untraveled country folks around these parts. She had been sent all the way to New Orleans when she was a girl, and had learned to read and write in both English and French. She had tasted the city, the real city. Not many in her circle made that claim. Emily reached the road that could take her to Natchitoches or Montgomery to the north, or Colfax to the south. Years ago, gangs of men had carved out the ugly thoroughfare, wide and asphalted. It was convenient, no doubt about that. The world had been a smaller place before these things they called progress reached them. Steamboats instead of railroads, horses instead of automobiles. But the improvements tended to be hard-edged and drab, one of the worst possible sins in Emily's book. She slowed her step and looked in first one direction and then the other. There was no traffic, no other person out walking. The bus line conformed to some sort of schedule, but she knew the bus would show up in its own good time, and all she had to do was wave it down however far she had managed to get along the road. She turned south on the hot asphalt, kept a steady pace until she finally heard the rattle of the bus behind her coming along Highway 71. As always happened when she knew she would be judged by strangers' eyes, she wished she were taller and more imposing. She was almost 5 feet, missing the mark by less than an inch, and she still hadn't managed to tip the scales beyond 100 pounds. Her waist had thickened with the passage of time, but even without her corset, she could have invited an admiring arm around it, if she had ever so decided. Her hair was pulled back and up severely, and arranged in a topknot to keep it off her neck in the heat. But if left free, it still hinted at the saucy brown color of her youth. It could reach almost to her waist. Sometimes she washed it just to see her old glory turn dark in her hands again while it was wet, before it dried and turned back to grayish-white. She wished she had on one of her serviceable long-billed bonnets, but she wouldn't wear them to town anymore since her granddaughter had told her they weren't fashionable. She wore a smaller bonnet, not as good to keep the sun off, but a pretty little thing. Her feet had spread from a lifetime of work and narrow shoes, but when she bought store-made shoes, she still needed the smallest possible adult size. And 75 years old, or no 75, she knew the touch of beauty was still with her. The unflawed, clear white skin with almost no wrinkles, the sharp but delicate features, the French nose, the beautiful long straight hair, with only the insinuation of the natural curl that might start minds thinking about the possibility of café au lait. The dingy silver country bus distinguished itself from the dust swirls that preceded it, and Emily lifted up her hand in a wave. The driver stopped. It had been over 5 years since she'd last taken the bus, and it seemed more crowded than she remembered. Whites in front, colored in back. She looked carefully at the passengers as she climbed the steps, including the bus driver, and when she didn't see anyone she recognized, she took her place in front and settled in for the ride, grateful to be off her feet. They were all strangers around her, outsiders who would probably never think to stop at Colfax, passing by on their way to some bigger town. Those who carried on conversations did so in English. It was an annoyance, but switching away from the easy Creole French in her head was one of the prices to pay to go to town. Someone had left a copy of this week's Natchitoches Reporter on the seat beside her, and it was open to the Letters to the Editor column. Emily didn't put much stock in keeping up with events reported in the newspapers, even when someone brought one out to the farm for her. They seemed to have so little to do with anything genuine or important, but today she needed to stay alert. It wouldn't do to drift off and miss the Colfax stop 9 miles away. She read to occupy her mind.
They're trying to get the name of Highway 71 changed to FDD Durban Highway, Emily said excitedly, pointing out the article in the newspaper to the woman sitting across the aisle from her, a bosomy matron in a flowered dress, white-gloved hands clutching her purse.
These are my people they're talking about.
The woman smiled at her politely, indulgently, but didn't encourage further conversation, leaning back and closing her eyes to signal that she was resting and unavailable. The words had come out in French. Just as well, Emily thought. It had been both foolish and dangerous to talk to a stranger in the front of the bus. Emily sat back and read the article through again. François Dion Després d'Urban was a distant ancestor who had helped set up Natchitoches as a trading post years before New Orleans existed. Her Joseph had told her all about the explorer when he had laid out her father's bloodline for her, and she had spent countless hours as a teenager rolling that beautiful name over her tongue and begging him for more stories. François Dion Després d'Urban. It had to be the same man, and it was his same blood running through her. She folded the newspaper carefully and pushed it deep into her bag. The bumpy ride of the bus on the country road created its own rhythm, and Emily relaxed into it. She had become much more dreamy of late than she could ever recall being before, and often sharp, fresh memories of 50 or 70 years ago crowded out the necessities of today. Sometimes they gave her great pleasure, like good friends come calling. The bus shifted gears abruptly, and Emily looked out the windows at the thinned woods on each side. Joseph had owned all of this at one time, and she had helped him get it. The Colfax stop was close. Good thing. She needed to spit. Chapter 48. Emily stepped off the bus. Colfax, Louisiana, the sign said. Population 1400. The weathered sign hadn't changed for at least 20 years that she knew of, and it was already 1936. She still had a long walk down the wide, dusty road to the other side of town. Across the street from Tuminello's general store, a loose knot of men idled around the grandstand, swapping stories, and Emily heard a short burst of laughter behind her as she entered the relative darkness of the store. Some of the men were old enough to know who she was, but she felt a little reckless today. The very smell of the place assaulted her, triggering memories, good and bad. The store was empty except for the bored-looking young white man behind the counter. This young one didn't know her. She always sent someone else in to pick up supplies, but Colfax was a small town, and her story might be known, if not her face. She wandered around the store, drinking in the remembered magic of places like this, while the boy eyed her. "Can I help you, ma'am?" He had round, owl-like eyes, dark, slick hair, a thin nose that took a sharp, downward curve near the tip. She could see herself through his eyes. Another old-line French woman come down from the country, dressed better than most, back straighter than most, who might not have enough money to buy the goods on the shelves. Many of the folks around Colfax didn't have much, and he had a right to be suspicious. Why should he know about the $1,300 in cash she had sewn in her mattress, more than some of these farmers had seen in a lifetime?
"Thank you," Emily said to the boy. "I need to browse a bit before I'm ready."
She wandered down the two aisles, slowly, and after she filled up on the sights and sounds and smells of the store, she got down to business. She needed a new pair of shoes. Riding in the front of a bus where no one knew her was one thing. Trying on a pair of shoes in a general store where she could be recognized at any moment was another. She wasn't feeling that rash. She picked out the smallest pair of women's shoes she saw, matching their general outline to the bottom of her own overrun shoes, and carried them up to the front of the store.
"I haven't seen you in here before," the boy behind the counter said, taking the shoes from her.
"You from Colfax?"
"I'm from up the road. Aloha."
"It's been a long time since I was here.
My name is Emilie Fredieu."
"Glad to see you in the store, Mrs. Fredieu. I just started here not too long ago myself. I'm still getting to know everybody. Will this be all for you today?"
"Add 5 tins of Red Rooster snuff, please."
"Yes, ma'am. Anything else?"
10 sticks of peppermint candy. My granddaughter is coming to visit this afternoon, and she has a sweet tooth as demanding as mine."
"A little girl?"
Emilie laughed, thinking of how her outspoken granddaughter, Willie D., would react to the question. Willie was high yellow, her brown eyes always seeming to blaze with curiosity, reminding Emilie of Tio in his youth. That and her long, slender fingers. But she had also gotten a heavy dose of spunk and her big feet from Eva. Her granddaughter considered herself fully grown, with a quick tongue and the sassy arrogance of a 15-year-old accustomed to being chased by all of the local colored boys.
"Not so little anymore. She's bringing her latest beau out to see me. One of the Tadimi boys.
Another family I don't know."
The boy stacked her purchases on the counter. He took his stubby pencil and began to add up her total as he talked.
"You picked a good time to come in. There's going to be a rally across the street starting soon. Jim Fletcher running for police jury."
Emilie was suddenly wary and anxious to be back home.
"How much is it going to be?" she asked.
The bell over the front door of the store shrilled loudly, and Emilie started. A well-dressed but overly powdered older woman entered, dominating the room. She eyed Emilie sharply, and then turned to the clerk.
5 pounds of flour and 2 pounds of coffee."
"Let me finish up here with Mrs. Fredieu, Mrs. Fletcher, and I'll get right on it."
"Excuse me?
You help me now. Miss Emilie will be glad to wait."
The boy looked closely at Emilie, as if memorizing her facial features, and back to Lucille Fletcher's unyielding expression.
"Step aside, Miss Emilie."
His tone became curt, full of authority. With a sweep of his hand, he pushed aside her items to clear space. The lid from one of the tins of snuff loosened, and a dark sprinkling of brown tobacco spilled on the counter.
"The order for Mrs. Fletcher is next."
Emilie concentrated on the rich, sour smell of the snuff, wanting the potent comfort of it in her mouth, even thinking for a reckless moment of reaching out to take a pinch. She backed away from the counter, one small step, then two, and stood quietly while the boy retrieved the white woman's order. The bell rang again, and a young woman with dark, unruly hair came into the store. The woman stood by and waited patiently for her turn at the counter. When Mrs. Fletcher left, the boy turned his attention to the newest arrival.
"Something I can help you with?"
he asked her politely.
She nodded toward Emilie. "I think she was here first."
Her words had a strange, flat tone.
"She knows her place. I can help you next."
"You from around here, ma'am?"
"I'm from Oklahoma, visiting my aunt. My name is Sarah Feraldo." "How can I help you today, Miss Feraldo?"
Emilie calculated the distance between the counter and the entryway, allowed herself one last look at the snuff tins, and eased toward the door. Careful not to make any sudden motions, she opened it slowly. The bell rang out as if she had yanked it.
"Hold on. What about these things you picked out?"
Emily gave a small, weak smile as the old familiar queasiness gnawed.
I don't need them after all. Thank you kindly.
She walked away from the store empty-handed, listening for angry steps in pursuit behind her, and began to breathe more regularly when there were none. The wind carried bits and pieces of the politician's words as they spread over the small crowd gathered around the grandstand.
It's up to us to teach them how to accept with humility the limitations placed on them. They must always remember to accept with grace their inferiority. If you elect me, I'll protect our way.
She didn't look back. She walked on, past the cafe to the bus stop, and settled herself to wait for the Montgomery local. Cooking smells from the cafe wafted up as Emily waited for the bus, and her stomach complained in response. It had been a long time since breakfast. The sun beat hot directly overhead, and she felt a powerful need for food, water, or snuff. A tall white farmer in dirty overalls and a wide straw hat approached the cafe. From the shade of the cafe's doorway, the owner beckoned.
"Come on in out of the hot sun," the man said to the farmer. "We have a special that looks mighty good today, and a breeze to help you enjoy it."
The men disappeared into the cool of the cafe. It was the dinner hour, and while Emily waited, a pair in a few singles entered the diner. A man the color of strong coffee in a well-worn jacket and trousers went around to the back door and reappeared later with a brown bag. He found a thin patch of shade under an elm tree, sat on the ground, and began to eat. "I'll never be hungry enough to go to anyone's back door," Emily thought. When the northbound bus finally came, emitting its noxious fumes as it slowed to a halt, Emily was the only passenger to get on. She shook off the dust of Colfax, raised her chin slightly, dropped her nickels into the driver's waiting palm, and walked deliberately to the front seat, composing herself for the ride home.
The End. You've been listening to Cane River by Lalita Tatamy, narrated by Robin Miles. The author includes the following note. My great-grandmother Emily died in bed at her Louisiana home at the end of the summer of 1936, with $1,300 in cash hidden under her mattress. Although she passed away 12 years before I was born, her presence is firmly imprinted in our family lore. Neither my mother nor her brothers ever talk about Emily without a respectful catch in their throat, without a lingering note of adoration in their tone. I've been told that great-grandma Teet, Emily's nickname, rhymed with sweet, was very beautiful, and this is verified by the four photographs I have of her, two of which hang on the wall of my home in California. She was full of life into her 70s. Dancing alone in the front room of her Aloha farmhouse on Cornfine Bayou to the music from her old Victrola, high-stepping and whirling to the cheering on of family gathered on Sunday visiting day. Always at the end of her performance, she would arch her spine and kick back one leg, little booted foot suspended in air beneath her long dress until the clapping stopped. It was her trademark move. My mother and all of the other surviving grandchildren remember this vividly. Laughter and fun surrounded Grandma Teet, they say, describing the flawless skin, thick chestnut hair, high cheekbones, thin sharp nose, and impossibly narrow waist. My mother has said to me often, each time with a proud, wistful smile, she was an elegant lady, like Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy. I always found this last statement impossible to embrace. I now know that Emily Frejia was born a slave in 1861, lived deep in the secluded backcountry of central Louisiana, dipped snuff, and drank homemade wine every day, insisting that all visitors, even children, drink along with her. She bore 5 children out of wedlock over the 30-plus year span of her liaison with my great-grandfather, a Frenchman. Interracial marriage wasn't against the law, for all of the time they were together, but it was dangerous and against custom for a colored woman, even if she did look white, and a white man to be together. My great-grandmother Emily was color-struck. She barely tolerated being called colored, and never Negro. My mother, the lightest of the grandchildren, with skin white enough to pass if she chose, was a favorite of hers. It is difficult to reconcile these facts and confirm my mother's judgment of elegant. I was always unsympathetic to the memory of Emily because of her skin color biases, although I never dared say so to my mother. But at the same time, I was envious of Emily's ability to stare down the defeats of her life and aggressively claim joy as her right in ways I had never learned to do. Emily fascinated me for years, an untapped mystery. But my life was too busy to dwell on impractical musings with no identified purpose. I loved my world, jolting awake every morning, impatient to begin the day, savoring the next deal, the next business to build or turn around, the next promotion. For 2 decades, I had hoisted myself upward, hand over hand up the corporate ladder, until I was a vice president for a Fortune 500 high technology company in Silicon Valley. The position brought all-consuming work, status, long hours, and stock options. But every so often, while reviewing strategic businesses in small airless rooms, I found myself secretly thinking about Emily, who she was, how she came to be. During budget reviews, my mind would drift to Emily's mother, Philomène, about whom I knew so little, only as a name in a brief 2-page family history written 20 years before by a great cousin and sent to me by my uncle. I began to develop a nagging and unmanageable itch to identify Philomène's mother, to find out if she lived on a plantation as someone else's property, a slave, or if she had been free. In 1995, driven by a hunger that I could not name, I surprised myself and quit my job, walking away from a coveted position for which I had spent my life preparing. Crossing back and forth from California to Louisiana, I interviewed family members and local historians, learning just how tangled the roots of family trees could become. I scanned documents until headaches drove me from moldy basements, where census records or badly preserved old newspapers from the 1800s and early 1900s were stored. In assorted Louisiana courthouses, I waded through deeds, wills, inventories, land claims, and trial proceedings. Joining the Natchitoches Genealogy Society led me to some private collections, including letters. The search for my ancestors moved beyond a pastime and became an obsession. A series of discoveries challenged what I thought I knew about Louisiana, slavery, race, and class. I thought Creole meant mixed-race people, black and white, but was informed in clipped tones that Creoles were only the white French-speaking descendants of the early French settlers, a snobbish distinction that clearly separated them from the black families the Creole men created on the side, as well as elevating them above their lower-class French-speaking Cajun cousins. I discovered that most plantations were not like the sprawling expanses of Tara in Gone with the Wind, but were small, self-contained communities, surrounded by farms that were smaller still. I discovered that the horrifying institution of slavery played out in individual dramas as varied as there were different farms and plantations, masters and slaves. As I tightened my search for Philomène's mother, the trail led to Cane River, a complex, isolated, close-knit, and hierarchical society whose heyday was in the early 1800s. It was a community that stretched 19 miles along a river in central Louisiana, where Creole French planters, free people of color, and slaves coexisted in convoluted and sometimes non-stereotypical ways. In Cane River, the free people of color, or gens de couleur libre, had accumulated a great deal of land and wealth and were just as likely to be slave owners as their white neighbors. As a child, I had spent many muggy summers in Colfax, a small country town not far from Cane River, where both my parents grew up. The road trip there took days, with me sandwiched in tight between my brother and sisters in the back seat of our 1951 Ford, riding cross-country from California to Colfax for our annual two-week stay in July. In 1978, my father and I took a roots trip to Louisiana, my first time to go back by choice. My mother sent me off with a must-talk-to list for her side of the family, and it included an elderly great-cousin living in Shreveport, Louisiana. My father drove us the 100 miles from Colfax, and we were eagerly welcomed into the home of a large, light-skinned woman with dark, piercing eyes. I still remember those eyes. Cousin Gertie lived alone, and radiated something almost touchable, a relish for life, an intensity, an undefeatable spirit. She was chatty, but her mind wandered, one minute talking about her shoelaces and what she had for breakfast, the next spinning tales of distant ancestors, grisly murders, suicides, and forbidden love. I assumed she exaggerated for effect, but I was hooked. It wasn't until sitting down to write this author's note 22 years later that I realized she was the same woman who had produced the 2-page typewritten family history I relied on so heavily in trying to recreate my family's past. She had not exaggerated. When I quit my job in 1995, I hired a genealogist to help with the search for Philomène's mother. It took her 2 years before she found the bill of sale in a private collection of French plantation records that positively identified Suzette as Philomène's mother. Only then was I sure that my ancestors were not free people of color. They were 3 generations of slaves owned by Françoise d'Herbonne, a Creole widow whose husband left her a medium-sized plantation in Cane River, Louisiana. It was then that I resolved I would not allow Suzette or her family to be lost from memory again. Revealed bit by bit from mounds of documents and family stories, I connected the line backward between these women of my family, daughter to mother, from Emily back to Philomène to Suzette and Elizabeth. They were not Mammy or Jezebel or Topsy, the slave images made safe and familiar in Gone with the Wind tradition. They were flesh-and-blood women who made hard choices, even in oppression. Emily's mother, Philomène, came to life before any of the others. She visited my dreams, urging me to tell their stories. No, urging is too tame a word, too remote. Philomène demanded that I struggle to understand the different generations of my family and the complexities of their lives. She made it unacceptable that any of them be reduced or forgotten. It defies description in words, this bond I have with Philomène, and her ability to reach across 4 generations to me with such impact. There were demanding days in the beginning when I feared her, a shapeless apparition, usually in the aftermath of her unrelenting hand at my back and the unnerving certainty of her voice in my ear. But the fear was always tempered with respect. This book is a work of fiction deeply rooted in years of research, historical fact, and family lore. The details of Cousin Gertie's accounting weren't always supported by other documents I uncovered. Some dates were off, some facts twisted. But I found that each precious line of her carefully typed history had at its base at least a grain of truth. And a family story had arisen around it. Many official and historical documents had inaccuracies in them as well. The challenge was to marry all of the data. In piecing together events from personal and public sources, especially when they conflicted, I relied on my own intuition, a sometimes intimidating undertaking when I felt Philomène's judgmental presence over my shoulder. There were gaps I filled in, based on research into the events and mood of the place and time, I presupposed motivations. Occasionally I changed a name, date, or circumstance to accommodate narrative flow. I hope I have captured the essence of truth, if not always the precision of fact, and that liberties I have taken will be forgiven. I hope you can put some of these things together better than I did.
You may have heard that my brother or I did not finish school, or no one taught me one thing about typing, but that I know it. Smile. My God have blessed me to be here my 70. Cousin Gertie Frigia, in a letter recording our family history written in 1975. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends What You Owe Me by B.B. Moore Campbell, narrated by Caroline Clay. And In Search of Black America, Discovering the African American Dream by David J. Dent, narrated by Dion Graham. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.